Before we get to the show, we're a few weeks into the Newsmatch campaign, and we need your help. As a listener of the world, you know the value of our journalism. Now is the time to step up and support it. Make a donation today at theworld.org/match to double your impact. That's theworld.org/match. Thank you. The new NAFTA deal is done, and it's being welcomed as a win-win-win.
Really, the U.S. isn't exporting U.S. goods, and Mexico isn't exporting Mexican goods, and Canada isn't exporting Canadian goods. We're exporting North American goods.
Here's the thing about the big trade deal, also known as the USMCA. We don't really know yet how different it is from the old NAFTA.
There are lots of the bad things that were originally in NAFTA still in this deal. The big question is it better enough to try and stop some of the ongoing damage?
Also, in Madrid this week, climate activists want to know who's taking the lead now that the U.S. is not.
The EU-China cooperation in this context becomes more important.
I'm Marco Werman. Those stories and more today here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. It took some time, but the deal got done. NAFTA 2.0, also known as the USMCA. Officials from the U.S., Canada, and Mexico met to finalize a deal in Mexico City, where U.S. Trade Representative Robert Lighthizer described it this way.
The result, I think, is the best trade agreement in history. And together, all of our teams did this. And it's something that's going to make North America richer. It's going to make America richer, it's going to make Canada richer, and it's going to make Mexico richer.
The deal still has to be passed by legislatures in all three countries, but what does the USMCA change from the old NAFTA? We'll have views from all three partners to the deal, starting here in the U.S. Lori Wallach is with Public Citizen, a consumer advocacy group in Washington. She gave me her take on who wins and who loses with NAFTA 2.0.
The winners are ostensibly the working people in North America, if it works. After 26 years of NAFTA, we see wages in Mexico lower than before NAFTA and 40% lower than manufacturing wages in China. This has drawn a million U.S. government certified, million outsourced U.S. jobs. So the goal was to try and stop some of that damage.
So in your opinion, is the USMCA better for U.S. workers and consumers than NAFTA?
It's better than the original NAFTA in that the outrageous investor state dispute settlement system, where multinational corporations can sue against domestic environmental and health laws and get unlimited compensation from taxpayers, that outrageous regime is largely removed from NAFTA. The big open question is, are the environmental and labor standards and their enforcement strong enough to stop NAFTA's original sin of job outsourcing?
The main sticking points for House Democrats were environmental concerns, also labor rights and costs of pharmaceuticals. What specifically were they worried about?
Well, the problem with NAFTA, dirty little secret, is it's not mainly about trade. It sets up all kinds of rights and privileges for corporations. And so the Democrats were trying to get the bad things out of NAFTA and to add affirmative labor and environmental standards that basically set a floor of conduct. But again, this is an agreement about fixing an existing bad agreement and trying to ameliorate its ongoing damage. This is not the template for a good modern agreement. It's better to have a better agreement than the agreement you know is dreadful. But it's an outstanding question about whether the new agreement is going to make enough of a difference. And if not, I think there's going to be a clamoring in 2 or 3 years to renegotiate it again.
Lori Wallach of Public Citizen with the consumer advocacy take on the USMCA. North of the border, the Canadian government is taking a victory lap. Here's Deputy Prime Minister Chrystia Freeland.
All of us together have finally accomplished what we set out to do at the very outset. A win-win-win agreement, which will provide stability for workers in all three of our countries for many years to come.
But some Canadians have a different take.
The main thing that's been gained is an element of stability after the White House blew up the existing perfectly satisfactory trade arrangement.
That's Gordon Ritchie, the former Canadian ambassador for trade negotiations. He helped broker the original Canadian-U.S. Free Trade Agreement, the deal that came before NAFTA.
It's an important achievement, and I would say that Lighthizer, the special trade representative, has done a good job in difficult circumstances. But the fact remains that the achievement is getting back to where we were. Now, there are some modest changes, largely cosmetic and political. It gives the American worker a little more encouragement to believe that the jobs that have been lost over the past considerable period of time may come back. That will prove illusory, but for the moment it gives them that comfort. And there have been some modest technical changes that may be of some benefit.
Canadian Deputy Prime Minister Chrystia Freeland cited the dispute resolution mechanism as a good thing for Canada. Is it a good thing for Canada?
Well, it was the linchpin of the original agreement. It has been highly successful in imposing something of a rule of law on our dealings with the United States, which is a major offender in terms of abusive use of its so-called trade remedies. And there has been some benefit over the years from that. Mr. Lighthizer, the special trade representative, had as one of his principal goals to gut that system. And it appears that he has ultimately backed down on that. I say it appears because there are many ways to make a system fail, as he has demonstrated with respect to the WTO. But at this point, it looks as if we still have a legitimate system to keep trade between us relatively fair.
Former Canadian Trade Ambassador Gordon Ritchie there. In Mexico, President Andrés Manuel López Obrador praised the trade deal, and he's not alone. Arturo Sarucán is a former Mexican ambassador to the U.S.
This Mexican administration has probably blinked more than I would like it to see blinking in the face of U.S. pressure. I think that some of the last-minute concessions that were made could have been avoided. But I think that on the whole, this is a positive thing for Mexico.
Sarucán points out the original NAFTA was written at a time when e-commerce was a fringe idea. At the heart of this new trade agreement, of course, are the workers who make the goods or provide the services. Evi Peña says there's one group in North America that may stand to benefit in new ways, migrant workers.
We see very positive changes, that there's a labor chapter, that migrant workers are explicitly mentioned. We see provisions about violence in the workplace, about gender.
Peña is in Mexico City with the Centro de los Derechos del Migrante, the Center for Migrant Rights.
And most importantly, in this new agreement, migrant workers will have access to the dispute settlement mechanism used to address other trade-related disputes, which means that labor is put at the same level as other trade-related matters.
What is that mechanism, actually? What does that do?
So it's a series of steps. So when we're talking about submitting complaints, that's part of the dispute settlement mechanism. It's basically the process under which a migrant worker or any other stakeholder that is affected and covered by this trade deal can access justice under the agreement.
So how did it used to be? How did the complaint mechanism operate under NAFTA?
Well, because it was a labor side accord, it wasn't actually explicitly part of the agreement. Mm. We found that the dispute settlement mechanism was toothless. So basically, the complaints that we filed didn't go anywhere.
So what are kind of the typical working conditions migrant workers might experience that would result in a violation?
We're concerned with abuse from the moments that migrant workers are recruited in their home communities. And then once they arrive to their workplaces, they often see that the conditions are far different from what they were promised in their home communities. They don't have access to breaks or proper housing. And once they return to their communities, when talking about temporary labor migration programs, they don't have access to justice. It's very difficult for them to find a lawyer who will represent them.
So as an advocate for labor rights, you are happy with this new deal?
We are happy with this new deal. There are positive changes, and they may seem minor, but it's really an opportunity to address some of the biggest challenges that we've previously faced when using the previous trinational trade deal.
Evi Peña in Mexico City with the Centro de los Derechos del Migrante, the Center for Migrant Rights. Thank you for being with us.
Thank you.
leaving North America now and to Madrid, where world leaders are expected to commit to new, deeper cuts in greenhouse gas emissions by next fall. It's all part of the Paris Climate Agreement, but those cuts are voluntary. In fact, the whole climate pact is essentially based on peer pressure. As UN climate talks in Madrid wrap up this week, one question looms large. Which countries will take the lead to push for more action? The U.S. used to play that role, but no longer. It plans to pull out of the pact. As Rachel Waldholtz reports from Madrid, that means all eyes are now on the European Union and China.
Perhaps the most important news at the UN climate talks today actually happened 800 miles away from this sprawling Madrid conference center where negotiators are hammering out next steps in the Paris Climate Agreement.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to all of you.
Instead, it happened in Brussels. That's where the head of the European Commission, Ursula von der Leyen, unveiled the European Green Deal.
This is a very special day.
A proposal to overhaul the continent's economy with the goal of becoming completely carbon neutral by 2050. She called it Europe's man on the moon moment.
The European Green Deal is on one hand our vision for a climate neutral continent in 2050, and it's on the other hand a very dedicated roadmap.
The Green Deal is a big deal.
Lola Vallejo is a climate analyst with the Paris think tank IDDRI. She was keeping an eye on the announcement from here in Madrid.
It's really about reinventing the way we produce things, we consume things.
European heads of state will vote on whether to formally approve the Green Deal's target of becoming carbon neutral by 2050 later this week. Advocates say the move is crucial to send a signal that the EU is firmly stepping into the leadership void left when the US announced plans to pull out of the Paris Agreement.
So if the EU is seen as, you know, the last leader standing, we really need the EU to step up and to step up now ahead of this next COP in Glasgow.
So that's the big question here. Will the EU commit to major carbon-cutting targets? And will it be enough to nudge other countries to set their own more ambitious goals? In the coffee-fueled halls of the conference here in Madrid, many people are looking to recent history as a model. Back in 2014, under the Obama administration, the U.S. and China struck a deal and together announced plans to reduce their greenhouse gas emissions. That announcement was seen as critical to paving the way for the Paris Agreement. Sue Binney has worked on the deal.
Well, it's hard to know whether Paris would have happened without it, but I do think it was highly significant.
Binias says the fact that they came together made other countries believe that a deal in Paris was possible. The agreement, and a lot of diplomacy, led to a cascade of other commitments.
It was kind of remarkable that by the time the Paris conference started, even before it had begun, something like 185 countries had come forward.
Many people here are hoping the EU could take the US's place this time around, and an EU-China deal ahead of the 2020 deadline could trigger a similar cascade of commitments. Li Shuo is with Greenpeace China. He describes international climate negotiations as a tricycle with three wheels, the world's three largest carbon emitters, China, the U.S., and the EU. As the U.S. steps back, he says, the other two have to step up.
So the EU-China cooperation in this context becomes more important.
Li says that China could make serious new commitments in 2020. It's currently on track to beat its pledge under the Paris Agreement, which was to peak its emissions by 2030. But China's situation has also changed since Paris. Domestic politics, including a slowing economy and protests in Hong Kong, may make it harder to commit to ambitious new climate policies. And China is still building new coal-fired power plants.
It is really going to be a political decision that the Chinese leaders need to make in 2020, whether to double down from our current climate targets or not.
And Li says U.S. actions loom large over China's decision-making, as it does over the whole process.
Even if we will be able to achieve a successful EU-China outcome next year, we're not going to solve the climate problem because there is still another 100-pound gorilla in the room, which is the United States.
The U.S. is the gorilla in every room here. U.S. delegates are still attending negotiations, but the Trump administration has been mostly absent from public events. So as delegates head into the final stretch in Madrid, they'll be keeping their eye on Brussels to see if the EU adopts its ambitious carbon target this week and whether China eventually follows its lead. For The World, I'm Rachel Waldholz in Madrid.
You're with The World. As a listener of The World, you know that our journalists bring new perspectives and insights to issues like climate change. Just this year, reporter Carolyn Beeler spent 2 months on an expedition to Antarctica, studying the effects of climate change and reporting for The World. Shirin Jafari took us inside Saudi Arabia to report on the changing role of women there and barriers to those changes. Producer Daniel Offman and I traveled to Russia to meet young people who love Vladimir Putin and others who organize in opposition to him. Not every newsroom would invest in this kind of reporting, but we do. If you value in-depth, on-the-ground journalism that brings you right into the story, then step up and support it today. A gift of any size makes a difference, but if you donate $60 today, that will be doubled to $120. Just visit theworld.org/match. Thanks very much. I'm Marco Werman. It's The World. For a lot of millennials out there, buying or even renting a home can seem impossible. Forget about the idea of starting a family. But in South Korea, the Seoul city government is providing some incentives. It's got programs aimed at helping young couples secure housing and just maybe have a kid. Kelly Kasulis in Seoul has a story.
It's one of those first cold nights of the winter, and I'm walking around Seoul with an address in hand. It's actually a really cute neighborhood. They have a little cafe street with Christmas lights out right now, and lots of good restaurants. I'm meeting So Ji-hae and Cho Sung-won, a couple who fell in love at church and got married 3 years ago. They've invited me over to their new apartment, which they say the government helped them buy. I punch in the passcode and head into their building. Yeah, this is like a really swanky apartment. It's no secret that this is a family home. Ji-hae and Sung-won's wedding photos are all over the walls, and the government hopes that subsidizing homes like this will encourage young couples to have kids. Ji-hae and Sung-won have already started.
Hi.
Their 2-year-old son, Hansol, comes home with his grandmother. He wants to show me his room with his books, his rocking horse, and his child-sized piano.
Wow.
Sung-won says the government has helped them afford a much nicer place for their family.
일단 크기가 커져 넓어졌으니까 우선
I love it here because it's much more spacious than our last apartment. And my mother-in-law lives next door. My son is getting bigger, so he needs more space to, you know, run around.
Sung-won tells me that raising a family here in Seoul would be much harder if they didn't have government help. Seoul was ranked the 7th most expensive city in the world last year. The city government runs several programs that help pay the mortgage interest when newlywed couples buy homes or the deposit when they rent. In this family's case, the government is giving them about $76,000 over the next 30 years to pay for their house.
아이가 활동할 수 있는 집을 갖게 되는데
The subsidy had a huge impact on our ability to purchase a house for a kid. It definitely took a big economic burden off our shoulders.
A government official told me that Seoul City plans to subsidize about 25,000 families with these programs, which started in 2018, and the aid could last for years. That's a lot of money to just give away, but South Korea has one of the lowest birth rates in the world, and the government is worried. I called Andrew Ungi Kim, a professor at Korea University, to ask why young Koreans aren't starting families.
Number one reason in surveys show is that they are not financially stable enough, that they don't have solid jobs. So they're worried about not being able to take care of their family if they do have one financially.
Ji-hae and Sung-won also get a monthly stipend until their son turns 6 years old. Right now it's about $250 a month, and the amount decreases as he gets older. It's too soon to know if the government assistance will encourage more South Korean couples to have children. But in Ji-hae's case, it seems to be working. She's 10 weeks pregnant with their second child.
임신했을 때 한 소리를 놓고 기도를 하면서
Ever since I gave birth to Hansol, I've just prayed that he becomes a person who has a lot of love to share.
Before I go, she makes sure I hear her son sing a song.
고독한 비운
고요한 밤 거룩한 밤
For the world, Kelly Kasulis, Seoul.
어둠에
Learn more about one Seoul couple that gets a new lease on life with subsidized rent, that's at theworld.org. When New Zealand's White Island volcano erupted this week, dozens of tourists were there on the island. 8 people were killed. 28 people are in critical condition at the hospital with serious burns, and there is still a list of people who are missing. Our BBC colleague Shaima Halil is at Whakatane Harbor, where evacuees were taken after Monday's eruption.
The haze and smoke from White Island's volcanic eruption still hover over the area. I can just about make it out standing here on the windy shores of Whakatane Harbour. People were brought here when they were first evacuated, but not all of them made it out. 8 bodies are still on the island, just a boat ride away from where I am, all covered in ash. After the police have confirmed time and time again that surveillance aircraft have seen no sign of life, this is very much a recovery operation, but even that hasn't been possible. Conditions are still too unstable in the area. Officials say there is a 50% chance of a smaller or a similar size eruption in the next 24 hours. Russell Clark is one of the paramedics who helped move the injured into safety. He described the scene on the island.
It was like the Chernobyl miniseries. Everything was just blanketed in ash. It's pretty overwhelming. I mean, the amount of dust, it really hits home. I can only imagine what it was like for the people that were there at the time. They had nowhere to go, an absolutely terrible experience for them. Both traumatic and emotional recovery is going to take a long time.
White Island is one of New Zealand's most active volcanoes, but also a very popular tourist destination. Mary Scully lives close to the Whakatane Harbour and has once gone on a trip to the volcano in White Island with a local guide who is also a family friend. Hayden Marshall Inman was on the island that day.
I've known Hayden since he was primary school age, going through the swimming club, soccer and all the things that kids do. He's the same age as our son. He's one of those really good guys. Yeah, so it's very sad.
Do you think there should have been more warnings to people, given the high alert? Should they have been there?
We hear that there's an alert on White Island, and if you're not going out there, of course it doesn't mean anything to you, but it could have been fine yesterday and it could have blown up next Saturday.
Unpredictable.
Yeah, it's like, when is a good time for a mountain to blow its top?
How has this affected you, what happened?
It just makes us aware of the fact that there is always danger, and it might not be that. It might be just simply going out on a boat, out into the sea or something like that. And it's a wake-up call.
Police are now investigating circumstances of the death and injuries on White Island, an active volcano that has long been a tourist attraction but has now turned into a site of utter devastation.
The BBC's Shaima Halil reporting on the aftermath of the volcano eruption in New Zealand. Authorities had hoped they would be able to retrieve the stranded bodies of victims on the island, but the White Island volcano was showing increased seismic activity today, putting those recovery efforts on hold. You're with the world. Facebook can get pretty nasty, and now some former content moderators who work for the company are suing for psychological trauma they experienced on the job.
This was the first time I'd ever talked about all the horrible stuff I'd had to see. I'd never even discussed it with my wife. And I literally broke down and cried in a coffee shop.
That's still ahead here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, WGBH, and PRX. A massive trove of documents about the U.S. war in Afghanistan was released this week by The Washington Post, and one issue that gets a lot of attention in these so-called Afghanistan papers is corruption. Over and over again, officials interviewed for the Lessons Learned report from the Office of the Special Inspector General for Afghanistan Reconstruction, they emphasized the toxic and central role that corruption played in hampering U.S. efforts in Afghanistan from day one. One estimate is that 40% of U.S. aid dollars for Afghanistan since 2001 was pocketed by officials, gangsters, warlords, drug lords, or insurgents. Sarah Peck is a lawyer and former diplomat. She served as an anti-corruption officer at the U.S. Embassy in Kabul from 2009 to 2010. Because of that experience, she was asked to read and comment on an early draft of the Special Inspector General report long before it was made public. It was in 2009, the year you arrived in Kabul, Sarah, that Mike Mullen, who was then the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, he said corruption in Afghanistan was as much of a threat to the country as the Taliban. Is that what you found when you were there?
Yes, I did.
And what did you find specifically?
Some of the things that I look back and remember were schools that were built that had teachers who never showed up. They were ghost teachers. And roads that were built but were never completed. And courthouses that also were built and never used. They ended up being goat houses.
By goat houses, you mean like buildings that had a purpose but then not used except by goats as shelter?
Exactly. So we were building schools and courthouses according to Western standards. And at the same time, there was no oversight for the building. And there was also no operating budget for them long term. So there would be a building in the middle of a rural place with no use other than to store grain or goats. And in the process of building those buildings and those roads, the political elite with connections would get those contracts, and then they would peel off their share, and then it would go to subcontractors and down the line. And there was little oversight because it was so dangerous that aid workers couldn't actually go to the sites many times or detect whether or not people were showing up. And then I remember sitting in meetings where people were trying to address the problem of huge sums of money being put into suitcases and flown out of the country.
The report and interviews published in the Washington Post say the CIA, the U.S. military, the State Department, other agencies used cash and lucrative contracts to win allegiance of warlords and drug traffickers and defense contractors. What was the thinking behind that?
Well, for the people who are trying to counter corruption, we weren't part of that decision making, and we were learning about it in the press, I think, as the rest of the community was learning about it. But there was certainly a desire to persuade these leaders by paying them off rather than by pressuring them and conditioning the assistance on improved governance.
I mean, the really stunning quote we see in the Washington Post report, U.S. officials were, quote, so desperate to have the alcoholics to the table, we kept pouring them drinks. That was an unidentified interviewee in the report. Point being that pouring money into Afghanistan was actually fueling corruption. Is that what your task force concluded?
Yes, the answer is yes. We had something called a rock drill in spring 2010 that brought together the leaders of the international community and leaders from Washington and from the embassy and the military to talk about all aspects of the mission in Afghanistan. And as the anti-corruption officer, I gave a report on the status of our efforts to fight corruption and informed my supervisor that I intended to say that our spending and our efforts were fueling corruption in Afghanistan. And I was told, if you say that, we're going to send you home.
Wow.
As it turns out, I did end up getting permission to say that to this entire community of leaders. And so there is no doubt as of spring 2010 that that was the understanding of the entire international and U.S. mission.
It strikes me that at the end of a fiscal year, it's a common thing for businesses to look at what they spent and whether they need the same amount in the next year's budget or whether it would be excess and possible waste. I mean, wasn't that a fundamental part of assessing the budget for Afghanistan at the Pentagon? Did they take that simple step?
My understanding was that there was money that was budgeted and then the people on the ground did not question that amount. Instead, they looked for every way possible to spend it. And there's this bureaucrat's viewpoint that you must spend what you have because you might get less next year if you don't spend it all. And so as a result, I remember a USAID person who was supposed to be buying books and supplies like that, saying that he or she was buying art books, those lavish books with color plates, because they were so expensive. And that was how they were able to spend their entire book budget. So I think that was really more the problem is we had the budget and we wanted to spend it.
So what were the main conclusions of your anti-corruption task force, Sarah?
And what we were doing then was trying to figure out ways that we might target the most egregious corrupt offenders in the government and somehow, through some form of policy or action, prevent them from their actions. And so on my side, I was trying to advocate for even the most modest idea, like not sending some of these people to training in the U.S. or to conferences, or not appearing in photographs with them, or not inviting them to official events. And I could not get any of these kinds of initiatives approved by the embassy.
So are you saying that no one in the U.S. government was receptive to the criticism of what you were saying and your task force?
I think the problem was that people were well aware that corruption was a problem. I think they prioritized security as being even more important without the recognition that they were both intricately related to each other, and that by having these officials be supported by the U.S., they were empowered, they became more brutal, they alienated their population, who also was alienated by the U.S. because they thought the U.S. must support corruption in these activities because they're supporting these people. And it was a vicious cycle that ultimately undermined our mission.
Sarah Peck is a former U.S. diplomat who served as the anti-corruption officer at the U.S. Embassy in Kabul from 2009 to 2010. Sarah, thank you very much.
My pleasure. Thank you.
A large crowd gathered outside the Palace of Fine Arts in Mexico City yesterday. It wasn't a line to see a painting, it was to protest a painting. The painting is titled La Revolución by Fabián Chérez. It depicts the Mexican revolutionary hero Emiliano Zapata riding a white horse, an aroused white horse. Zapata is naked except for a pink sombrero and black heels. A ribbon striped with the Mexican tricolors of red, white, and green is also draped around his body. It is certainly unconventional. You can see for yourself. It's on our Instagram at PRI The World. But some say it's just offensive. Protesters say the painting depicts Zapata as gay, and they want the work removed. Zapata's grandson, Jorge Zapata Gonzalez, says the painting denigrates the legacy of the late leader.
It is not only the family who is unhappy about the painting. The whole state is against that filthy painting. If they do not hear our request, we will find a way to remove it.
Some of the protesters were shouting homophobic slurs. That led to counter demonstrations by LGBTQ activists, and things got violent.
Cuidado, cuidado.
The artist Fabián Chérez said he got the idea for the painting after noticing that Zapata's masculinity is glorified in most representations. This work is part of an exhibition marking the 100th anniversary of Zapata's death. Protesters said they would block the entrance to the museum until the painting was taken down. Museum officials are refusing the demand. They say the painting will stay put. Facebook has rules about what you can and can't post. Hate speech, not allowed. Death threats, also no. Same thing goes for pornography and most violent content. So to police the platform, Facebook relies on thousands of content moderators around the world. Most of them are contractors. They work for third-party companies like CPL Resources in Ireland. Now, some former CPL employees are suing the company along with Facebook. They say they suffered psychological trauma on the job. Here's The World's Lydia Emanuelidou, and a warning here, this story includes some especially disturbing details.
A couple years ago, Chris Gray walked into Facebook's Dublin office for his first day of work.
It's one of these very trendy Californian style open offices, bright yellow emojis painted on the wall. It's all very pretty, very airy, seems very cool.
Gray wasn't a Facebook employee, though he took this job hoping that one day he would be. He was a contractor hired through CPL Resources in Dublin. He started working there the summer of 2017, just as Facebook was coming off of a series of high-profile incidents.
Police in Thailand say a man filmed himself on Facebook Live, killing his baby daughter on Monday, the second such video to emerge on Facebook in less than 2 weeks.
Facebook was scrambling to keep posts like this off the site, and this is where Chris Gray comes in. He was one of thousands hired that year to review posts that had been flagged on Facebook. He'd look at the video, photo, or text and decide what to do with it. Take it down, mark it with a warning, or leave it up.
After a few months, I was moved to the high priority queue, which is hate speech, graphic violence, bullying, all that kind of nasty stuff that is really important to act on very quickly.
Can you give some examples of the types of things that you would see, you know, day in and day out?
I really don't like to talk in detail about this stuff, but, you know, executions, terrorists beheading people, ethnic cleansing in Myanmar, bestiality, I mean, you name it, all the worst of humanity, really.
On busy days, Gray would walk into work to find 800 of these posts waiting in his queue. He had to sift through them carefully and quickly because Facebook was auditing the decisions he was making and keeping a score. Gray was working 37 and a half hours a week, making about $14 an hour. Gray says he wasn't talking about the disturbing stuff he was seeing with anyone. He was under a strict non-disclosure agreement. It wasn't until a whole year after he left the company that he opened up about the work he did for Facebook. He was at a coffee shop speaking with a journalist.
This was the first time I'd ever talked about all the horrible stuff I'd had to see. I'd never even discussed it with my wife. And I literally broke down and cried in a coffee shop. You know, I just did not know what was happening to me.
Gray went to see a doctor who diagnosed him with post-traumatic stress disorder, PTSD, something he says was a result of his 9-month stint at the contractor, CPL. Last week, Gray and several other former employees filed a lawsuit against CPL and Facebook in Ireland's High Court. They want damages for the psychological trauma they say they endured and better working conditions for content moderators. CPL didn't respond to my interview request. Facebook told me in a statement that they, quote, recognize this review work can be difficult. They say they work with their partners to make sure employees have access to the support they need. Sean Burke says this wasn't his experience. He's another former CPL employee who's suing. He started working there in 2017.
So on the first day, one of my first tickets was watching footage of someone being beaten to death with a plank of wood with nails in it. Within the second week of the job, it was my first time ever seeing child porn.
He saw videos of people being decapitated, videos of people committing suicide. Not everything he was reviewing was this disturbing, but these are the posts that stuck with him. Burke was doing the night shift. He'd come in to hundreds of posts every day, do his work, get home around 3 or 4 in the morning and try to get to sleep. And when he finally did, he'd have nightmares about the things he saw on his computer screen at work.
You're seeing the worst that humanity has to offer, and you just become completely disheartened.
Burke felt like he needed help and support, and so he went to CPL's wellness center. They had yoga, finger painting classes, and people he could talk to.
Unfortunately, you know, they can't do anything to help you cope or manage with the material or the environment. They're kind of just there as a shoulder to lean and cry on.
So he turned to his own doctor, who prescribed him anxiety medication, and it helped. But after a few months, Burke was let go from CPL. His accuracy rating fell below 98. Remember, every decision he made was audited to see if he did a good enough job applying Facebook's rules, rules that he says are complicated and constantly evolving. Facebook says eventually most of this crucial content moderation work will be automated, done by sophisticated algorithms, but the technology is not there yet. In the meantime, Corey Kreider, who's assisting with the lawsuit, says she wants better conditions for the humans doing the work. She's with the London-based nonprofit Foxglove.
Facebook and other social media platforms could not exist without the labor that these people provide. You wouldn't set foot in it because it would just be awash in abuse and pornography and violence. And the people who are on the front lines of this battle, making the platforms a place that's just about usable for us all, they're really paying the price right now.
She wants Facebook and its partners to provide better mental health support and to limit how much toxic content moderators are exposed to.
So if you think, for example, about police investigating child abuse cases here in the UK, they have very serious psychological support and actually limits on the amount of time they're permitted to be exposed to that stuff. So if the company had just taken a little bit closer look at comparative examples of other people who do this sensitive work, they could have done better.
Chris Gray, the content moderator who was diagnosed with PTSD, agrees, but he says figuring out the best way to keep the internet and people who moderate it safe is not easy.
And I don't think Facebook should be ashamed that they haven't got it right yet. I think they just need to say, okay, we're learning, we're doing our best, we've made mistakes, and it appears that some people have suffered as a result of those mistakes, and we're going to make that right.
In the meantime, he says he's staying off Facebook and all other social media. For The World, I'm Lydia Emanuelidou.
There are nearly 200 different types of visas for people entering the U.S. This next story is about one of those visas, the U visa. It offers immigrants who are the victims of crimes protection from deportation in exchange for cooperating with the police. But the program is not working the way it's supposed to. That's what our partners at Reveal learned when reporter Laura Morell dug into it. She tells the story of one woman, Natalie Alcantara.
Natalie is originally from Honduras. Back home, she was an accountant, and she owned a home, and she had a pretty happy life. But like a lot of other residents in her country, she started getting death threats from local gangs, and they threatened her that if she didn't give them half of her paycheck, that they would kill her son, who at the time was 18 months old. Wow. So that's what brought her to the United States, and she settled in the city of Miami. But what ended up happening to Natalie is that a few months after coming here, she and her family were the victims of a really violent home invasion robbery at their house. There were two women, one armed with a gun, the other one with a knife. So she ended up giving them about $300 in cash, which was basically all the family had in savings at the time. And the women ran out the front door.
So Natalie flees these death threats in Honduras. She braves the overland trek north to the U.S. But then living in Miami in this supposedly safer world, she's robbed. Then what happened?
10 or 11 squad cars show up outside, and then police officers start putting crime scene tape around the house. And then TV reporters show up a few hours later to interview her about what happened.
Crime scene investigators came out here just a short time ago. They were taking pictures in the grass behind this home. And at this point, the investigation continues. Detectives really want to find these women.
And throughout all of this, Natalie cooperated with police. She followed up with them regularly. She invited them to her home where they showed her mugshots of potential suspects. She also called her stolen cell phone to see if the women would pick up. Mm. And when they did, she told the police right away to see if this might be a way for them to track down the suspects.
So this whole time that Natalie's cooperating with Miami police, she's undocumented, right?
Yeah, so she found out about the U visa through a friend. And basically what the U visa does is that it offers temporary status to victims of violent crimes that are cooperating with law enforcement. But Natalie's story shows that this doesn't always work the way that it should.
Yeah, how so? What happened in Natalie's case?
For victims to apply for the U visa, they need to have this document called a certification signed by the investigating agency. And basically what this form confirms is that A, they were the victim of a violent crime, and B, that they were helpful to law enforcement. But in Natalie's case, when she applied for the certification, her lawyer received a letter in the mail denying the request without any sort of explanation. And the lawyer ended up calling the department to learn more about what happened. And they told her that it was essentially because there wasn't an arrest in the case.
I mean, it sounds like she was cooperating, but because there was no arrest, I mean, that's it? Is that what the U visa hinges on?
Actually, it doesn't. The way Congress created the U visa, basically, the victim just has to be helpful in some way. And that doesn't mean that there has to be an arrest in the case. All it means is that the victim was willing to come forward and help investigators or prosecutors in any way that they could.
This is one case in Miami, Laura. What did you find out about other cases? Is like what happened to Natalie a trend?
Between 2016 and 2018, the department received 235 certification requests and only approved 27, which means that they were denying about 90% of cases.
Wow.
And I wanted to find out why, so I reached out to Miami Police Chief George Colina.
How do you plan to make sure that the approval rate improves, or to make sure that you have a streamlined process for these requests coming in and for the consideration that they get?
I'm going to ask them to. So fortunately, I'm in a position here as the chief of police where I can find out, because like I said, it's on us. We need to be mindful of the people that we're here to protect, everyone.
So that's the situation in Miami, Laura. What about nationally?
So for the past 10 months, I've been looking into this question, right? And what I found is that law enforcement routinely undermine the U visa and block victims from applying for this relief. I reached out to more than 100 agencies around the country that serve large immigrant communities. And what I found is that nearly 1 in 4 have some sort of additional barrier in place that goes beyond what the U visa criteria asks for. So basically, victims are at the mercy of whatever internal rules law enforcement choose to abide by.
Yeah. Why aren't police departments around the country more engaged with the U visa program?
The main thing that lawyers and advocates I spoke to told me is that they suspect some of this might be the anti-immigrant sentiment that's becoming more mainstream in the country right now. And another part of it might just be a lack of understanding about how the U visa works. There's this one officer I spoke to at the San Francisco Police Department who does trainings around the country. And one of the most common questions he gets from officers is, if I sign this paper, am I granting this person status? And that's not how it works at all. This paper is just one of several that victims have to turn in to even apply for this relief. So there's really a lot of misconceptions out there about it. And the U visa was created by Congress in order to help police departments build trust with the immigrant community. It was meant to be a crime-fighting tool for law enforcement. And when law enforcement agencies don't take advantage of it, then a lot of experts I talked to said that their communities are less safe because of it.
As for Natalie, who helped investigate the crime on her and the police who didn't kind of support her with her visa process, where is she now?
So Natalie is still in Florida. She's with her partner, and they have 3 kids now. And they're trying to move on with their lives. Her toddler son, who witnessed the robbery, lost most of his vocabulary, and she ended up having to take him to speech therapy. He would burst into tears when he saw people in dark clothes, because I guess it reminded him about the robbers. She still feels some of the effects sometimes. She told me that she has a hard time being alone because she still gets scared. So when she's home with the kids after they get home from school, she grabs a chair from the dining room and puts it against the front door. So that way, if someone does try to come in, she'll be able to hear them and be alerted to what's going on.
Laura, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you so much for having me.
Laura Morell is a reporter with our partner, Reveal, from the Center for Investigative Reporting. Read Laura's deep dive into the problems with the U visa program on our website. That's theworld.org. From the Nan and Bill Harris studio here at WGBH in Boston, I'm Marco Werman. We're back with you tomorrow.
The World is a co-production of WGBH Boston, the BBC World Service, and PRX.